Today, it's almost rare to come across someone who doesn't have a Facebook or Twitter or LinkedIn account. And while social networking sites are great for winning friends and influencing people, they can just as easily lead to you losing friends or worse jobs and alienating people. So what do you do when unflattering pictures, controversial postings, or negative reviews make you or your business look bad? Well, you hire an online reputation management specialist, of course. These services are popping up claiming to help protect and repair ruined online reputations. How do they work? And more importantly, are they worth it? To find out, I'm joined now by Shinny Jardin. She's a tech culture blogger and co-editor of the blog Boing Boing. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks.
So what do these reputation management services actually do?
Depends on the service, and it also depends on which level of product you pay for from which company. But I would say that probably the best known of these companies used to be called Reputation Defender. Now they're just calling themselves Reputation.com. They're out of Silicon Valley, and they purport to help you protect your internet privacy. So depending on how much you pay them, the service may involve tracking what public records leak online, to helping parents protect their kids from, embarrassing postings on Friendster or Facebook or MySpace. There's premium services that companies like this offer where they'll, let's say, email a blog that has written something unflattering about you. The fact that you, if you're a celebrity and you looked really bad in a particular dress at a particular awards show, or if you're, let's say, a senator and you were caught doing something that a senator ought not to do.
But, okay, having talked about cost, how much do they cost? Isn't it a big difference between, shall we say, regular folk and the celebrity senator types?
If you take a look at the Reputation.com site now, it most of what they are marketing are the sort of $12.95 to $19.95 range a month for just services for regular folks. And then as I understand it, there's figures that are more in the sort of five-figure range, like 10,000 and up, to secure what are more like traditional publicity services. The trick is, though, I view these services with the same kind of skepticism that I think a lot of us view, say, credit protection, credit monitoring services, or companies that purport to help you with bankruptcy. There's a big and real problem. But these companies are exploiting a need, and I don't know that they're truly offering the solution that consumers need.
Shinny, as far as most of us that aren't computer savvy think, once something is online, I mean, isn't it pretty much out there forever? So isn't it kind of incumbent upon you as a person to not post, unfortunate pictures to your Facebook page or rant about your employer on Twitter?
The easy and obvious answer to that question is yes, but we all make mistakes. That said, there's an eternal joke on the internet called the Streisand effect. Barbara Streisand once had this battle with these different websites that were posting photos of her house off the coast of California, and she tried to get her lawyers to go after all these different websites and take them down. What ended up happening is that the photos ended up spreading exponentially wider than they would have if she just kind of kept her mouth shut. So that's shorthand for exactly what you just said. That said, these firms can and do sometimes get results.
If you're just joining us, I'm Allison Keyes, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. And I'm speaking with tech culture expert Shinny Jardin about social media networks and managing one's online image. Shinny, you've said you're skeptical about some of these online reputation management services because you think that they are connected with some services that publish personal data online. What's your evidence for that?
You know, it's hard to tell. I remember, for instance, when Spokio.com burst into public awareness some months back. This was a site where you can enter anyone's name and generally find a lot more information than you might expect about them. Nobody is exactly sure where all of that information comes from, but on the Spokio website, there's a page that suggests what you ought to do if you're concerned about that. And they point to reputation.com. I emailed the company a while ago, Spokio, asking if they were owned by the same company. The answer wasn't entirely clear. Whether or not there is sort of a directly visible financial relationship between the two companies, it's obvious to me that there's sort of two sides of the same coin in the marketplace. You have one set of startups that profit by exposing the heck out of your data, and then another set of companies that want to exploit your well-based fears that your data is leaking out there.
So, Shani, what are your practical tips for protecting yourself from that unfortunate Google search result?
If you're drunk and naked at a party, stay away from cameras. There are a number of kind of practical, basic privacy hygiene steps that we all can take. For instance, you know, contacting our credit card companies and our banks and proactively making sure that the greatest privacy protection is in effect, that, you know, they're not sharing your credit history with third parties, that sort of thing. Another tip that's often mentioned is using a P.O. box or a mailbox rental service instead of your personal home address. Some people who are more publicly visible are careful about making purchases in the name of a trust instead of their own personal name. Look, there are books written about this sort of thing. Talking about sort of your financial data and your physical data is one thing. When we're just talking about what we voluntarily post, that I think is more of an issue of mindfulness.
Let me ask you, though, because, of course, you said voluntary, but how do you stop that friend or frenemy or whomever from posting or tagging you in some picture?
Man, that's tough. I mean, some people have actually gone to court over this sort of thing. This is now the stuff of lawsuits. All I can say is, for myself personally, I ended up opting out of Facebook for that reason. I found the whole experience more frustrating in terms of social bonds than helpful. But I think just if they really are your friends and not your quote Facebook friends, you ought to be able to tell them, look, I didn't come here for a publicity shoot. I just came here to have dinner with you. Put the camera down and don't tag me.
I am not friending you. Shani Jardin is a tech culture journalist and co-editor of the blog Boing Boing. Thanks for joining us. And I guess just be careful out there.
Thank you very much.
A Republican plan for the 2012 budget unveiled this week includes an overhaul of Medicare. House Budget Chairman Paul Ryan, a Wisconsin Republican, wants to create a voucher-like program to replace the popular health insurance program for the elderly and disabled. Medicare has evolved since it was signed into law in 1965. For a look at how it's changed and why it's so expensive now, we turned to NPR health policy correspondent Julie Rovner. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with, what did Medicare look like just after it was passed? How much did it cost in 1965 compared to today?
Well, a whole lot less. Actually, I have numbers from 1970. It cost $7 billion. That was about 3.5% of federal spending. In 2010, the last full numbers we have, Medicare cost $524 billion. That's about 15% of federal spending. And obviously, it's expected to rise as 78 million baby boomers join the program.
Why, Julie, was Medicare passed in the first place?
Well, private insurance wasn't really available for the elderly at the time. Only about 14% of older people had insurance because insurance companies wouldn't sell to them. They were considered bad risks. They were likely to get sick because they were older. And so it was thought that the government needed to step in. And indeed, thanks to Medicare, about 99% of older people today have health insurance.
What were people able to get back when the program started? The universe of possible medicine and drugs was much smaller, right?
Absolutely. Think about the things that we have now that we didn't have then. Organ transplants, joint replacements, cholesterol-lowering statin drugs, the array of blood pressure drugs. None of those things existed in 1965, or they certainly didn't exist to the extent that they exist now. And in fact, the life expectancy at age 65 back in 1960 was about 14 years. Today, it's almost 19 years. So people are living longer, in large part thanks to a lot of those medical advances. But it's a big reason why Medicare is so much more expensive. There's so much more that medicine can do.
And there's so much more medicine that people expect to have.
Absolutely. And Medicare is not immune from being part of the rest of the healthcare system. It's one of the only sectors in the economy where, as you get more advances, things get more expensive rather than less expensive. We pay less for computers, less for fancy TVs, but medical advances always cost more and not less. Like it or hate it, there are a lot of things in the new healthcare law that are aimed to try and slow the increase in healthcare costs. Most of those, interestingly, are going to be done through Medicare, since Medicare is such a large part of the healthcare system, but it's not entirely clear how well or whether those will work.
And Medicare also covers more people than it did 45 years ago.
That's right. And it's not just because the population is larger, but Medicare actually has added more people to its population. Of course, it began only for the elderly. In 1972, Medicare added the disabled to its rolls. People with end-stage renal disease, with kidney failure, now get Medicare. Medicare also added more benefits, some more expensive things like prescription drugs that were added in 2003.
So what are the political perils of trying to overhaul Medicare? I mean, the most obvious one is it's really popular, people who vote don't want to lose what they've got.
That is the biggest one. And I think the Republicans who are trying to make some of these changes really know that this is a very political perilous thing that they are doing. But at some point, I think both Republicans and Democrats know that they're going to have to do something with 78 million baby boomers about to join the program, the first one starting this year. Something needs to be done to get Medicare costs under control for the long run.
NPR Health Policy Correspondent Julie Rovner, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The Masters Golf Tournament gets underway today. For a preview, we're joined by Christine Brennan, sports columnist for USA Today, who's in Augusta, Georgia. Good morning.
Good morning, Renee.
So let's begin, Christine, with who we should be watching.
Well, of course, Renee, it's always Phil and Tiger, Tiger and Phil. Let's start with Phil Mickelson. He's 40 years old. He's the defending champion here of the Masters. He just won on Sunday in a PGA Tour event in Houston. So he's coming in on a roll. But it's not been an easy year for Phil Mickelson at all. He's battling a form of arthritis, and both his wife and his mother have suffered from breast cancer the last couple of years. He hasn't played a whole lot better than Tiger Woods has played, except for last week. But because he's the defending champ and he has won three of the last seven Masters tournaments, Phil Mickelson, I think, is everyone's first choice.
And what about him? What's his sense of confidence, do you think?
It's sky high, through the roof, Renee. He's talked about it here this week. Phil Mickelson is one of those athletes who seems to understand and get it, the perspective, what he has, what he's been given, the millions and millions of dollars he's been able to make playing a game. And he talks about being a kid and how he's dreamed of always of as a child of playing golf in places like this. So when he drives back into the grounds of Augusta and National, the Masters, during this week, he becomes a little boy again. And I think that's one of the reasons he plays so well here.
So if it is, as you just said, Phil and Tiger, Tiger and Phil, let's talk about Tiger Woods. He's won Augusta four times, but his game hasn't been the same since scandal rocked his personal life.
That's it. You're right, Renee. And the question really is Tiger Woods still Tiger Woods? He's now 35 years old. He hasn't won, as you mentioned, since before his Thanksgiving 2009 run-in with that fire hydrant and the unraveling of his personal life. He's not playing well this year. He's only had one top 10 finish in four tournaments. This is Tiger Woods, usually wins most tournaments. And that's this year, in 2011. He still has four Masters wins, but his last one was in 2005. And yet, as I say, all of that, Renee, as much as he was reeling last year from the scandal when he came back to play after 5 months being off, Tiger Woods still finished tied for fourth at the Masters last year in the midst of everything that was going wrong in his life. Augusta National is made to help correct his mistakes. There's no rough, so if he hits the ball wayward off the tee, he can still get it back in play. If Tiger Woods is to win a major golf tournament this year, this would still most likely be the place.
Christine, talk to us about the younger golfers.
There are a lot of them, and they're coming on strong. You know, these are the players who grew up watching Tiger Woods. They learned from him, but they're not afraid of him. And they're more emboldened by the day when Tiger does not win another tournament. A few names. Nick Watney, he's 29 years old. He just won a few weeks ago on the PGA Tour. He has had just playing great golf. Five of his six tournaments this year, he's been in the top 10. Nick Watney is his name. Anthony Kim, 25 years old. Dustin Johnson, 26 years old, who is, again, one of those young guns. And younger men, Ricky Fowler, 22, Rory McIlroy, 21. They are 13 or 14 years younger than Tiger Woods and 18 years younger than Phil Mickelson, which is an amazing age gap.
So talking to us from the Masters Golf Tournament in Augusta, Georgia, Christine Brennan. She's a sports columnist for USA Today. Thanks very much.
Renee, thank you.
We'll be right back.
and next, Muses and Metaphor. As part of Tell Me More's celebration of National Poetry Month, we've been hearing your poetic tweets. We've been asking you to send us poems that are 140 characters or less through Twitter, and hundreds of you have responded. Today, we hear a tweet from writer Frida Karf of Neptune, New Jersey. She blogs at thedailyneurotic.com. Now remember, these are short, only 140 characters each. So here goes.
This is Frida Karf, and this is my tweet. The bees are somewhere creating a world out of pollen, musing in sweetness, tasting the work of the thoughtless moment.
I told you it was short. Let's play it again.
The bees are somewhere creating a world out of pollen, musing in sweetness, tasting the work of the thoughtless moment.
That's a poetic tweet submitted by Frida Karf. If you'd like to help us celebrate National Poetry Month, go to Twitter and tweet us your original poetry using fewer than 140 characters. If your poem is chosen, we'll help you record it for us and we will air it sometime this month. Tweet using the hashtag TMMPoetry. You can learn more at the Tell Me More website. Go to npr.org, click on the programs menu, and find Tell Me More.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. The woman running the nation's largest public school system has resigned. New York City Schools Chancellor Kathy Black was only in the job for 3 months, and she has always been controversial. And for more, we're joined by Beth Fertig. She's a senior education reporter for member station WNYC. Beth, why is Kathy Black leaving after being in the job for only 3 months?
Mayor Bloomberg had appointed her to this post back in November, and she came under attack immediately because she had no background at all in public education. Her entire career was in publishing. Her latest position was chair of the Hearst Magazines group. So it seemed like a very odd choice for someone so far out of field from education. And immediately a lot of education groups and parents started attacking her and saying she wasn't right for the job. And then recently her poll ratings had been very, very low. Two different polls found her at 17%. A lot of New Yorkers still didn't even know her. So this is what the mayor said this morning.
She and I met this morning, and we have mutually agreed that it is in the city's best interest if she steps down as chancellor. I will say I take full responsibility for the fact that this has not worked out as either of us had hoped and expected.
That was Mayor Bloomberg speaking, and it sounds like at least in a couple public forums that she didn't exactly connect with her audience.
Yeah, and it's kind of odd for someone who's so media savvy. Once she took office in January, she made a couple of gaffes. She was at a meeting with some parents in Lower Manhattan who were worried about overcrowding in their schools, and she joked, maybe you guys should think about birth control. And that joke didn't go over very well. She also got quite irritated at a meeting when parents and teachers and students were booing her because this was a meeting where the city was planning to close more than 20 low-performing schools, and she just sort of got a little grouchy with them, and that didn't go over very well. So it seemed like she was not really fitting in, so to speak.
You know, New York has experimented with people who come from outside the world of education in the past to run the city's schools. Was there something that she had done to try to make up for the fact that she didn't have that strong education background?
She continued to say that she was a type of person who liked to reach out, that she wanted to listen to others. And I followed her on a trip to a school just a couple of weeks ago where she seemed to have trouble connecting with the students and really engaging with them, except on the matter of, are you going to college? You know, she was a real cheerleader for that. And I asked her a few questions about, you know, you're new to this. Is there anything that's frustrating to you when you go to schools? Because anyone walking into a school sees things in New York, Michelle, whether it's libraries that may not be as full as you'd like them, or just the mere presence of security agents and metal detectors in some schools. And so I asked her, is there anything that frustrates you when you go into schools?
I must admit, I have not been angry or frustrated in any school that I've been into, and I guess I've been into, give or take, around 3 or 4 dozen, almost 40-something.
You haven't seen anything that's made you frustrated?
Well, you know, sometimes I'll see a teacher. I mean, it sounds silly, but I'll watch occasionally I've seen a principal walk by some, like, crunched up piece of paper. 99% of the time, they lean down and pick it up. For me, it's about leadership at the top.
And so again and again, Kathy Black would talk about the importance of leadership, where she would drop buzzwords like, we need effective teachers, we need our students to be college ready. But she never really came up with these specifics that people felt they needed to connect with her.
Mayor Bloomberg has named Dennis Walcott now to be the new chancellor. Can you tell us a little bit about him and his reception, how people are reacting upon hearing that news?
Dennis Walcott is a deputy mayor. He has long ties to many communities in New York. He was formerly head of the New York Urban League. He grew up in New York. He attended public schools. And he's been the deputy mayor who's been overseeing the New York City school system. So he's very well known. And the mayor clearly hopes people will feel more comfortable with him. However, he doesn't have the management experience that Mayor Bloomberg talked about when he appointed Kathy Black. And the city is facing huge budget cuts and the possibility of laying off 4,700 teachers.
Thank you, Beth.
You're welcome.
That's Beth Furtick. She's a senior education reporter at our member station, WNYC. E.L. Doctorow, author of the novels Ragtime and Billy Bathgate, is a master of the long-form narrative. But his latest effort, called All the Time in the World, is a collection of short fiction. Our reviewer, Alan Chu, says once you immerse yourself in these stories, you will wish you had all the time in the world.
Short stories should reveal something new to us about the main character and the world. That's the conventional wisdom about short fiction. And E.L. Doctorow works with that tradition in this collection of stories. He provides the reader with the sense that by the end of any of his short narratives, he'll reveal new things to us about the character's life, and with a little luck, about our own. That's what happens in the story Willie. An old man recalls the murderous family incident in his childhood that changed his life forever. And in Wakefield, we meet a conventional suburban commuter who decides he's mad as hell and not going to take it anymore. He abandons his family and hides in plain sight in a room above the family garage. In The Writer in the Family, the most conventional of these stories, and in many ways the most resonant, Doctorow gives a sharp account of how a budding artist, residing in the bosom of his family in the New York City borough of the Bronx, discovers his great literary powers. But all these stories work on another level, revealing news about the world, yes, but also revealing the mysteries that lie at the heart of human behavior. In the title story, set in the heart of Manhattan, the narrator notices the beauty in the everyday with a sharpness that makes every page a revelation. A shaft of sunlight lights up the street, he says, from a crack in the black sky. The clouds blow off. The air is all at once warm and humid. Water drips from the apartment house canopies. Gurgling rivulets run along the curbstone. I feel, he says, as if I've risen from one element to another. Read these fine stories, and you may find that you'll have that same feeling.
E.L. Doctorow's new collection of short fiction is called All the Time in the World. Our reviewer, Alan Chews, teaches writing at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. His new novel is called Song of Slaves in the Desert.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.